You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network Studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here to my right, we've got Martin Page.
How you doing, Mike?
Right next to him, we got Scott Gershon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know, different times, huh?
That's right. And across the table, we've got Andrew Sheps.
Hey, Mike.
And right next to me on my left, we've got Rob Arbitier.
Hello, Mike.
Guys, Bobby is not with us yet again.
What a surprise.
Oh, I'm shocked. How can we tell?
But you know what? We did get the email that he was going to be here.
We get that every week. We get that all the time.
But today he's not with us, and he's really missing out.
Hey, he's missing a big one.
Because our guest today is none other than Steve Picaro.
Steve, hey guys.
Welcome to the Audio Nowcast.
Thank you very much. And, great to be here.
I don't know if, you know, for the listeners out there, Steve Picaro is he's one of the founding members of Toto, and also is a legend in the whole keyboard and synth technology. I had a poster of him and David Page on my studio wall for the longest time. When
easy.
I was
calm down.
No, that the poster. Right.
Wasn't that red bathing suit poster, was it?
But it was with the DX7, it's kind of a it's coming out to have you here with us, Steve. So
it's great to be here.
So thank you. Before we get going, I just want to talk about a couple things. Number one, this will be the first Pro Tool-less podcast we've had in a while because, we've just way overdone the Pro Tools thing for the last couple podcasts.
Oh, you mean talking about Pro Tools?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was on Cubase or something for a second.
No Pro Tools.
It's a wire recorder either.
That, and there's absolutely positively going to be no llama talk. This podcast.
What a shame.
What about bunnies?
last podcast, Steve, Scott, we were talking about when he went out and recorded some sound effects of a llama.
It was disgusting. Disgusting.
Got out of control.
Did not go in there.
It just did not. Did not ever let up. The other thing that I want to talk to you really quick is we had somebody email us, and Connie emailed us and wanted to know about some software for her son to start. He wants to start getting into music. And he was interested in GarageBand or any other beginning software. And I just really quick, anybody have any recommendation for inexpensive software to start with their music career on?
Pro Tools LE.
You know what? Technically, he didn't break any rules.
We don't usually talk about LE, so that's okay. Or M-Powered, even. I think GarageBand's a great idea.
Yeah, I think
so,
too.
You can't beat the price, and it's really powerful.
The only problem I have with GarageBand is I think it could really make someone who's starting in music a little lazy because it's so easy to grab loops, it's so easy to grab MIDI sequences and just get locked into the whole loop-based arrangements of songs.
It's great training for today's radio, though. Makes it just as lazy as all the really successful.
I think they're all like that, though. I mean, unless you get Pro Tools LE, which is more of a recorder, Live, Reason, GarageBand, Session, they're all based on audio snippets or MIDI snippets and looping it and recording over the top. So,
it's
I mean, they're
want to
all
be a
great.
Player or a writer. I mean, if you're, you know.
But, you know, a player's going to use the stuff one way, and somebody who wants to deal with loops is going to use the stuff another way.
I think Live and GarageBand are the two that really allow you to record over the top the easiest. Mm-hmm. So those would be my recommendation if the guy plays an instrument and wants to sing.
The thing I like about GarageBand and loop-based sequencers is you can create something that sounds like music. Really easy. Even if you're not a musician, you can start down that road and you can kind of get the whole vibe of a verse and of a chorus and of a bridge. So I think that's a really good thing about GarageBand and loop-based synthesis. All right. Well, Connie,
I will say one other thing too. It's always a good idea to be using what your friends are using.
Yes.
Because it's good to have a network of people who you can go to for help, and to ask questions and to learn from. So if the people in your area are playing with a certain kind of software, it's a good idea to get on that same bandwagon just for the support.
I agree. That way you can all kind of learn and make mistakes together. So that's absolutely.
You know, to address what you're saying, option anxiety is going to be something that's going to be, you know, they should be teaching courses at that in UCLA. You know, it's going to be a reality for everybody as far as having too many choices and how to deal with that, you know.
Yeah,
the thousand drum sets, you know.
Yeah, and then you start hearing all the same sounds though on all your songs because you just don't want to go through all the different options. So it's like you get that one bass and you stick with that.
You stick with it forever. Yeah, step one though, if they're learning, it's getting a tool that you can learn so that you can use it without thinking about it, and then you can just be focusing on the music. And any of the software we've talked about is good for that.
But isn't it great though? I mean, your computer now is so much better than the Porta Studios. The little Tascam guys that we started with in days gone by.
Yeah, well, everybody definitely has a leg up on starting, especially when you can start with, you know, I think I'm going to start with 24 tracks. Right. Yeah. Yeah. From there, you know.
I miss the A-track, though, you know, the little cartridge thing. And,
well, you can miss it. Mm-hmm. All right, well, Connie, I hope that helps you out. We'll do another show on some software and a couple podcasts coming up, and we'll talk about some of this stuff more in depth later on. When I found out Steve was able to make it here, I did a little bit of research and I came up with a picture from the internet, and I want to show you guys this picture.
Oh,
and you could go to, if you want to see the picture that I'm showing, it's at modularsynth.co.uk.
Not enough wires in that picture.
And this pretty much just shows, you know, I can't even imagine trying to change a patch with this
thing. Is that the polyfusion?
And what we're looking at is a rack that has to be about, what, 7 feet tall, just modules. And I look at all these modules, and I look at all the wire, and the one thing that just sticks out is I've never seen hair that big.
you haven't met my son.
That's funny. But,
wow. Yeah, I think Jake's got you beat, but it's close.
It's pretty big then.
But Steve, we got to talk about the modular day.
Sure.
Steve, did you take that on the road with you?
I did. Good, it was gracious. Two of those.
And it's built into a road case. And Steve was saying before that what you can see in the picture is only half of the system. It was double wide.
Do you still have it?
Andrew, why don't you describe what you're looking at? Because you've got that golden, you know, throat. And
Well, I mean, basically, you're looking at Steve moving a patch cord on a polyfusion modular that is literally 7 feet tall and about, what, 4 feet across. And there were two of them. And there are 11 or 12 rows of modules with 15 modules in each row.
The roadies must have loved you.
And you're using the whole thing. This patch is using the whole. Like, what did that patch do?
I have no idea.
that looks to me like it's probably a hi-hat.
It was
It's
incredible.
Why don't you talk a little bit about modular synths and how do you, I mean, what is the signal flow on something like that and how many outputs were on
it? You know, it's a lot more impressive looking than, you know, what my knowledge of it was. I just wanted to be able to have lots of voices at the time, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, you know, the only way to have lots of voices was to have either mini Moogs lined up next to each other, or the more smart way to go was to have a modular system where I essentially, the reason I wanted it, like one of those systems was like 8 mini Moogs. If you look closely, mm-hmm. what's there?
Right.
It's just over and over again, the same two oscillators, a filter, an amplifier, and two envelopes, you know, over and over again. It was just to have multiple voices because I had gotten into this thing, Roland had a microcomposer, which was 8 synchronized. I was weighing the digital sequencers when they first came out, and I wanted 8 of them synchronized so I could write block harmony and, you know, do fast arpeggios but harmonized. And Roger Lynn, actually, who we were real good friends in those days and still are, he designed those systems for me. You know?
Wow. Now, are all those patch chords, are they all active on that particular sound?
Yeah.
Or do you have some where the filters are down and so to change patches you merely have to turn some knobs, or do you actually have to repatch on
those? No, the polyfusion stuff was all, there was nothing pre-patched. You had to patch in everything, unlike a lot of systems that are, you know, have some pre-patching. But really, it's so much simpler than it looks. As a matter of fact, I never really understood a mini Moog. What was going on a mini Moog until I learned that stuff. And with that, you could see everything. You could see exactly where everything's going and how it's going and why. And it really made all other synths, especially things like a mini Moog where you don't see everything that's going on behind the scenes, real easy to understand.
I took an electronic music class, and we started on an EMU modular system. And it really is amazing to see how, you know, when you work on those old systems, you actually pick your waveform on your oscillator, and you come out of that and you go into your filter, and you come out of that and you go into your VCA, and you go into your envelope, and it's a good visual way to learn how synthesis works and how basically all synthesis kind of starts out like that, and then it's just different ways of modifying that. How long did you work with that rack?
Quite a long time. I got it in like 79 when we started doing our second album, right before we did our second album. I got all the modular stuff and kept it through, you know, used it pretty much through 87, 88 or so.
Have you played with any of the software modular stuff, and how does that, what are your thoughts on that?
I love it. I use the Arturia Moog modular all the time now. That stuff looks great, but I'm like the grandparent now who looks at the antique furniture and says, I grew up with that. You can have that. I'd rather have a Formica that I can spill something on and wipe it off. You know, right. My Moog modular, I was always trying to get that stuff to sound like Moog as opposed to Polyfusion. I was always trying to distort the filters and trying to use Moog filters to try to make it sound like that, and my Arturia sounds great to me. I'm able to hit save. I'm one of those guys. I'm like, keep the change. You know what I mean? I mean, yeah, I totally miss the thing of having all those knobs and really being able to tweak. There's a part of that, an aspect of that I miss. But I'm spending more time with my family now and,
also do other things. With what production schedules are now.
Exactly.
The idea of taking the time to come up with the patches. Like we used to in the old days.
Exactly.
In the time you come up with one patch, you're supposed to have an entire piece of music finished.
Yeah, I'm in love with the fact that I did spend like 2 hours on a patch. Had to go do something else for a week, and was able to pick it up, you know, 3 weeks later, where it normally would have, you know, they would have been unpatched and changed, and all that time would have just gone off wherever and been wasted almost, but I was able to just pick up where I left off and keep working on it. And
did you used to notate your patches?
I tried to. You know, I've tried to notate everything. But
Was it hard when on the road that it would got a tune and stuff, and it was just
actually one good thing about the Polyfusion stuff was it was really rock solid. You know, I'd almost take it out of the cases and it would still be in tune from the previous gig, unless a knob was actually knocked.
That wasn't a Moog then.
Yeah, no, not exactly. That's amazing. It was really good, and we used it live. I kind of different sections did different stuff, and it was fun.
Well, I'd imagine live as well that it was very effective to look at. You know, for the audience. I mean, the lights and everything. Like,
I mean, get the sequencer modules up top. Not even hooked up. Always running.
No, but it was a big deal for me to actually use it.
Sure.
Be using it live. You know, that was my big source of pride for me.
You bet.
You know, after all the hours spent.
It's equivalent of the gong to the synthesis. A big wall behind you.
But, you know, that was back in the glory days of the synthesis, too, when you had, like, yourself, and you also had, like, you know, Jeff Downs from Asia with all those keyboards that he would have on. I mean, that was when it was just a big production to have all those keyboards on there. Back when Rob had 32 cases for Stevie Wonder that he had to lug in and set up.
Yeah, although I ended up using a lot of the modular stuff with Stevie later, but I wasn't around when it was actually new, which would have been cool. I learned it later because I basically started getting into that stuff in the mid-80s when I started with him.
Can you tell us a little bit about Toto and how the band started? You know, we should talk a little bit about that because I know Toto was one of the bands that was one of those must-buy albums because I would literally get the album and just listen to it for so many things. I mean, playing with the groove was just right off the bat. I mean, there was not a tighter band back then. But tell us a little bit about how the band started and through your time with the band.
Sure.
Where do you start?
No, the groove was really what it was all about. It started off as a rhythm section of my brother Jeff, David Page on keyboards, and David Hungate was the bass player, and they did a lot of sessions around town as a section. And David and my brother had been in a band in high school, which I kind of took over after they graduated, and Steve Lukather was in my band. Anyway, they had one of the sessions they did was where they were hired to do Silk Degrees with Boz Scaggs, the three of them. And David Page wound up writing all the songs on Silk Degrees with Boz. And then when they toured for that album, I joined them on the road playing synthesizers, and Steve Lukather joined them on the road playing guitar. So it was pretty much the record company Columbia was kind of seeing this band live, and they knew the writing chops were there because David Page had just written Silk Degrees, which was a huge album for Boz and Columbia, and we just plugged in a different lead singer, and that was the band, and we kind of never had to showcase or playing clubs or any of that kind of thing. We kind of, you know, the record deal was kind of right there, and that's how it started. But you know, and I, if my lot in life was going to be being the synth geek in the band, I was going to, you know what I mean, they were going to be the best synths I could do. So I really kind of poured myself into it, you know.
Yeah, because you guys were using a lot of Yamaha stuff right back then. I mean, again, because of the poster in the studio on my wall. But you were playing keyboards that not a lot of people even knew existed, like the DX1 and some of those olds. Do you miss any of those? Do you still have any of those? And
yeah, still got them, and I still miss some of it. But again, you know, the new stuff. I'm a lot more interested in the new stuff, to tell you the truth.
It's always been the new stuff. I mean,
it's always been the new stuff.
And the DX1 was the new stuff, and now there's newer stuff.
I mean, I could tell you what I miss about some of that old stuff, right. But, you know, you have to make choices. You got to make decisions. I mean, there's some guys that pull it all out and have it all set up all the time.
Right.
And, I just find that difficult to do and keep track of. And I love, in writing for film and TV, which is mostly what I do now, I love being able to get up old things, things I did 2 years ago, and being able to recreate them.
Right.
And the more it's been done with plugins or something I can recreate or something that has a preset I can get back to, the better.
If I could jump in, and as a fan of Toto and your work, as a songwriter, what was the influences of Toto at the beginning? What did you guys like and listen to before you all were making your own albums?
You know, we were it was a lot of studio musicians, and it was a lot of bands like Joe Cocker and Mad Dogs and Englishmen.
Yeah.
When Jeff and Paige were in school together, they used to do that set. Mm. You know, when we were kids and went and saw the movie Mad Dogs and Englishmen, we recreated that entire set from the movie and the album, you know, with Leon Russell in the band and Jim Horn on saxophone, and that entire band was all those guys. Jim Gordon and Jim Keltner were two of Jeff's heroes. On drums, and they would recreate with the horns and everything that entire set of Mad Dogs and Englishmen, as well as lots of you know, different R&B stuff. And,
there's a definite R&B influence, wasn't there?
Huge, huge. Yeah,
wonderful.
You know, a lot of, you know, playing a lot of dances in school, which is a drag that that kids don't get to do anymore. It's like you got to do pay to play at you know, the Roxy now. You know, when kids are coming up, there's dances don't exist. It's something that's really lacking, I think, for kids coming up.
You know, that's amazing that you were saying that you guys started as a rhythm, that Toto started as a rhythm section, because, I mean, come on, the classic Hold the Line. I mean, just the groove with the bass drum and the bass. It's just. I'll never forget. I was I was with my.
There's a tear coming from.
No. I was with my. I was with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and we were playing Toto and Hold the Line, and I was like humming the bass, and I was like, listen to this, and listen to this, the bass part. This is where the drums are going to go. Here we go. And she was like, she thought I was a genius because I was like predicting where the bass drum was going to hit.
And she married him because of that.
She still married him.
But it was like, wow, that was kind of cool, actually. You know, she's going, I've never heard anybody hum just the bass part.
You're sick, man.
But
neither have I.
Well, through the changes of technology, going from from obviously the synths and the modular to now we're back to software. Do you ever recreate any of those? Like, do you have a favorite filter, you know, oscillator, anything that you recreate in your modular stuff, or do you just, you know, you're just looking, just keeping it new, keeping it fresh, moving forward?
You know, all the new stuff keeps me interested. You know, I'm so much more interested in the new stuff, and believe me, all the stuff you learn as you're going through all this, it all comes in handy. You know, it's all served me well, but,
what kind of new stuff are you interested in now?
You know, mostly like the soft synths, you know, a lot of different soft synths. There's a thing called, Albino.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm loving Albino. Mm-hmm. I'm loving all the Arturia stuff. I think their stuff is brilliant. I use Logic, which I have a lot of problems with, but I love their soft synths and their, I'm just a fan of the, you know, of the new stuff, you know.
Did you, from the NAMM show, did you hear about the Arturia hardware box that they're coming out with?
I've just heard about it. I've not seen it, though.
It's going to be out like the 75th quarter of 2007.
But, what's great is you can
it's going to be cool when it comes out.
You can take the Moog filter with the ARP oscillator, so you can take all of them and start mixing and matching.
No kidding. This is the first time hearing about it.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And you can show the software on the screen and put all the DSP in the hardware. Great.
I think they do an amazing job.
Yeah, they do. Their stuff uses a lot of horsepower. It'll eat up your computer, but it sounds amazing.
And, you know, there's the purists that are you know, will say, well, there's nothing like the real thing, and it doesn't quite sound like the real thing. And I've been able to – there's patches I've been able to get on their stuff where it's not – I can fool the software and make it screw up. But overall, I'm not one of those purists. It completely fools me. And I like I said, I love being able to hit save and get on to the next piece of music.
Oh, as a working composer, that's everything.
Do you still use any of the old vintage keyboards at all?
Occasionally, I'll pull out my CS80. There's some things that, you know, where nothing else does it, and I'll want it, or someone else will want it, or usually it's probably one of the other guys who will force me. They'll say, come on, do... Quit dicking around and get it out. You know, pull it out. Do it like you used to do it. With the, you know what I mean? And I'll go, all right. They'll guilt me into actually, working for a living.
We weren't going to talk about touring, but.
You know. But not that much, you know. Not that much, to tell you the truth, you know. Again, it was, you know, back, you know, to the modular stuff, it was always about, I wanted to, it was about composing for me and hearing my notes.
Sure.
And being able to check out string parts and hearing them when I wanted to write for real strings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So, without taking a lot of, having never gone to college and being able to have students play my arrangements, you know what I mean? I thought, wouldn't it be great to have since be able to do it and be able to hear, you know, try stuff out. But then, of course, I got sucked into the fun part of the technology and I, you know, since kind of became my hobby outside of music, you know.
How was the progression of using computers in your rig? Were you using them way back in, you know, when you were touring when you first started? I mean, obviously they didn't have some of the same programs, but they had like some of the hardware sequencers and things like that. I mean, what was the evolution?
Yeah, no, we had, I'd use these microcomposers. Roland would have these specialized little computers, you know, little digital sequencers.
Like the MC500, those things.
And then we had a guy working with us who insisted he wouldn't work with us anymore until we got an IBM PC. And there was a thing Roland made called a 401.
The MPU 401.
MPU 401.
Yeah. And it ran with the MPS system, which was the worst MIDI sequencer ever created by man.
Okay.
I remember that thing. That
anyway, but what he did show us is that, because we just had a couple of these, we had the DX7s by that time.
Right.
And we just had, there was a couple, I think Prophet. There was just a couple other ones that had a MIDI plug in the back. But, you know, you asked me about logging all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You were asking me about logging everything. The first time I saw him hit a button and the bank of sounds, the names of all the sounds that were in that 32 piece bank came up on the screen, it was I heard voices and choirs and the heavens opened up. You know, it was an eye-opening experience. And we started bringing that stuff on the road, mostly just to backup stuff. And,
did you play with any of the bigger workstations at the time, Fairlights, Synclaviers?
You know, that was all out of our reach, out of my reach. I would have loved to have played with that stuff, but that was, you know, those things were thousands and thousands of dollars.
Yeah, that's something you buy two houses.
You know, that was all kind of out of my reach.
Now you can buy a porta potty.
The truth is, though, those super high-end systems from back then, they had amazing power, and you could store a ton of stuff, and they had huge libraries, but they weren't really going to create a great sound. You know, no one thinks back on those huge beasts and thinks of that as a great vintage sound that they want to get these days. When people think of a vintage sound, they're still going back to the analog synths from the 70s or 80s. But, you know, Synclavier, I lived and died with that thing.
A lot of music sound design and
But you know what?
Yeah, that airy, airy sound.
It's a cool brass, you know, that.
Yeah,
you know,
that Fairlighty brass, but you don't have
Peter
that.
Peter Gabriel, did a lot of cool stuff with the Fairlight.
We did, but I don't think of it as the mainstream vintage stuff.
Yeah, this what was so great about the Synclav, that what was so unique was just the high fineness of it, incredible the sound quality was.
Yeah.
You know, their sample rate compared to emulators and all these other, you know, toys when you compared it to what a Synclav could do. But now that's a non-issue, you know?
Yeah, but at that time, you know, the Commodore was the computer out there, and then all of a sudden you had a 32-track sequencer.
Or Atari,
But the Synclav could sample at 50 and 100 kilohertz.
Right.
That way it would not be compatible with crap, anything in the future.
No, but it's, and it's also now something you don't get nostalgic about. It's like, you
know, no, that's issue, what I'm saying. You know? I don't get nostalgic. I mean, I lived and died with Fairlights and Synclavs and stuff like that with Stevie, and I don't think back fondly to those time periods. And things like the PPG wave term. You know,
oh,
did you
God.
Fight that battle?
I did. I did.
You know, at the time I felt cool if I could get it to do anything.
You know,
really? The PPG was it?
Yeah. Well, no, the PPG, the wave was the keyboard, but the wave term. Right.
The wave term
was like
the
workstation
sampling
thing.
Interface.
Yeah.
My first big royalty check I got, I bought a wave and a wave term. Mm-hmm. Because I had heard that Thomas Dolby, this is how he got all his sounds.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know that he was just sampling a Jupiter 8 half the time or something into it. You know what I mean? Which I had two of, you know. So I bought one of these for like $15,000 or something like that. It was my first big, huge purchase like that. And the guy that they were sending to help me out, he was either coming from Stevie's or on his way to
Andy
Stevie's.
Thomas.
Andy Thomas.
Yeah.
Very good.
He was the only person on earth who knew how to use it.
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, he was always either at our place or on a wave to or from our place.
Yeah.
I knew how to use the wave term for like a week.
Yeah.
And we got a lot of stuff out of it and then I completely forgot.
Yeah.
And if I had to turn the thing on now, we still have,
do you really?
Stevie had, I think, 8 PPG wave keyboards and 7 wave terms, which is an investment like a house.
Wow.
But we still have road cases full of the 8-inch floppy disks from the wave terms. And
the big
I
ones?
Just, yeah, the big yeah. ones. Yeah. And I just hope we never have to go back to that.
10-inch floppy.
And I just remember everything was 2-letter commands.
Yes.
And it was all translated from German. So, you know, like DM would mean save or something. You know, it just didn't make any sense at all. It's just impossible to use.
Wow. The good old days.
No, they weren't.
Those bad old days.
Bad old days.
Some of your studio work back then, do you remember anything in particular, like where you tracked some of those albums at or any of the any of the places at?
Fondly, yeah. Record One is where we did, you know, a last bunch of stuff from Total Furana. Before that, it was Sunset Sound.
Hmm.
We did a lot of stuff at actually a studio that doesn't exist anymore. Richard Perry's place was right next to Paramount Studio 55. Was where we did our first album. And some of our second one. But Sunset Sound a lot. We were there a lot for the second album. And we actually did cut the tracks Total 4 at Sunset Sound with Al Schmidt.
Was the second album Hydra? Am I well off
Hydra,
on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's when we were going off on the
deep end.
What about the beginning of one of my favorite parts, Fahrenheit, that whole little intro part?
Yeah, I had this guy that I'd met. The producer David Foster had introduced me to this Canadian, Ralph Dyke, this guy who had done a lot of work with Roland. He did the original design on the Roland Microcomposer, which was this 8-channel sequencer, which used to baffle me and drive me crazy. So I'd gotten together with him, and he would bring me these tapes of this Canadian kid who had entered the Roland tape competition. You know, they had some synth competition, and this guy did all these things with a mini Moog and a 4-track. He was one of those. You know what I mean? And here I was with this room full of wave terms and modular stuff and PPGs and, you know what I mean? 2 Jupiters. And what this guy did with a mini Moog and a 4-track used to blow my mind, would make me, you know, feel like I had nothing going on.
Right.
So we finally, I got tired of hearing this guy's stuff. It was so great. So Paige flew him in, you know, flew him to spend some time with us and to hang out with the guy and see how he did what he did. And he just was this brilliant, you know, he was just this savant and still is. I'm in Batia. He's, we're doing something together right now. We're going back and forth on something. Yeah, he's this brilliant composer and he just had this amazing set of ears. He worked at a radio station. He was an engineer at a radio station, so his engineering chops were impeccable, always impeccable. And, you know, he did that intro to Fahrenheit with me.
That was a brilliant intro. I mean, I was in awe that sound could be designed that well, you know. Well, thank you for joining us here. We're going to take a little break because on the backside, guys, we're going to be talking about listening to music and how we listen to music and the different ways we listen to music.
You know, llamas have really big ears so they can hear music.
Why not? We have Pro Tools LE. All right, so we'll catch everybody on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the L.A. area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before we go on to the art of listening to music, Andrew, didn't you want to say something?
Well, Steve and I were having dinner earlier, and I was speaking about my Grammy experience.
That's right.
And so Steve had a very funny story about his first Grammy experience, which included Toto. So just, they were in the, from the first album, they were nominated for Best New Artist. And the field was quite incredible.
Yeah. The field was Toto, and the Cars were nominated for Best New Artist.
Wow.
Elvis Costello.
Elvis Costello.
Wow.
Was also nominated. And it was someone else and Taste of Honey.
Wow.
Taste of Honey won.
Wow.
You know,
really?
With that field.
Wow.
So I feel much better about losing.
And it just put the Grammys in perspective for me. It's very, very good, you know. And several years later, we did very well at the Grammys, but I kept my perspective.
How many years after was it that you won the awards after the
Grammys? It was for Toto 4, so it was 4 years later or so, 4 or 5 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And what a night that was.
Yes.
How many Grammys was that? That was like 4 or 5 Grammys
The band, all together, 7 for the band.
Wow. Wow.
That's a good night.
A good night.
Yeah. Excellent.
Will you let Andrew hold one of the Grammys?
It's funny because I was at a bookstore the other day, and, you know, of course, the critics, you know what I mean? The critics were appalled, you know? And even a couple of years ago, I was in a bookstore, and there was like a history of the Grammys by NARAs. And, you know, I look up, you know, of course I look up 1983, our year of the Grammys, and it's like the first sentence was like, it was a dark year for the Grammys.
<It's> like, NARAs. This is NARAs. You know, the people who gave you the award.
This isn't Robert Hilburn. This is like NARAs. You know, it was a bad year.
And Milli Vanilli was a real triumph. You know?
But it was funny.
Wow. it starts there and goes downhill.
Wow.
Amazing.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, in the last segment, you were talking about you like moving on to new sounds and new things. Mm. You know, it really puts you in the driver's seat when you are the person who comes up with those quote unquote cliche sounds. Because a lot of those sounds you guys came up with first, and then everybody ripped you off from there, you know, and especially using a lot of the DX7s and a lot of DX7 sounds. And I was listening to some of your old albums in prepping for the show, and it was really amazing to think at that time some of the stuff that you guys were doing and how well it kind of blended in with just the whole band in general. I mean, nobody really popped out too much. I mean, the sounds all kind of, you know, your pads and your horns complemented the real horns or the real strings. And there was definitely an art to just putting together those albums back then. Were you guys really conscious of doing that when you were doing your patches and your sound design for some of your songs?
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, a lot of the credit goes to the engineers who took all these thick guitar sounds and keyboard sounds and somehow, you know, made it all work. They just released Toto 4 in 5.1, and we went to Capitol to listen to it, and I heard they put some of my stuff, you know, by itself, panning around in the rears, and I started crying because I hadn't heard those sounds since I'd done them 20-something years ago. You know what I mean? They'd been buried in a mix, you know. But, it was nice.
You know, well, that brings us to this next part. I want to talk to you guys. I had somebody email me, and he asked me how I listen to music. And I thought that was at first a really ridiculous question because obviously with my ears, but but no, there's I kind of see where he was going with it in the fact that
it's a very profound question.
Well, it is because I realize that I listen to music two different ways. I listen to it on a very technical aspect. Like I would buy an album and I would listen to it. You know, when the Toto album came out, I'd tear it apart and I'd listen to the sounds, and then sometimes, you know, I listen to a record or a CD on a very emotional level where I just kind of let the music kind of seep into me and kind of just almost set the tone and kind of take over a little bit. And I just wanted to, you know, spend some time talking about that concept with you guys. I mean, Martin, how do you listen to music? Do you tend to, you know, can you compartmentalize it as, you know, technical or emotional or or
I think it's changed over the years because of technology now. You know, I tend to, in the early days, I would buy an album, and that was a real special thing to buy. It was a book, and so you would tend to live with it much longer, and it seemed to be really special to get into the artist today with, you know, iTunes and the way you can just get music, download it so quickly. I think it's easier to forget what's coming at you, and I think we get so much to go through. In the older days, you know, you would treasure that one album you bought, and so you'd sit and you'd really listen to it. You'd listen to all 12 songs, and you'd want to know about how the artist thought, and you'd get very close to the artist that way. I think with today's technology, it's harder to get nearer the artist in a soulful way. Just harder, because it's so easy to hear so much stuff, you know, and now they're talking about, you know, if you like this artist, you'll like that, and if you like this, you'll like that. So there's so much. But in the older days, I tended to listen to an album for a month and really, really, really get into it. Like we were talking earlier, you know, you could say I grew up at the era of the Beatles, you know, so you'd listen to Hard Day's Night and you'd really know everything about it as a kid. Then, you know, along came, you know, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road by Elton John, and you had a whole, you know, a whole world to go through. And then, you'd, you know, I was a Genesis fan as well, so things like Selling England by the Pound I would live with. And of course you go through your emotional periods in your life with these albums and they become really, really special to you. And but now, at this point, I tend to look for cherishable things more. You know, I'm tending to look for that one thing where I go, well, I think I could get into the artist on this project. I listen to music very different ways now. I tend to, you know, do a exercise walk by listening to my favorite selected songs on iTunes, and that's become a joy and a new way to listen to music. And I use it for in the car a great deal, you know, which we never used to do in the early days as much, you know. I just think that I'm adapting to what technology is allowing me to listen to, and I think today you have to be, you know, pretty careful about what you listen for, what you're looking for, because there's so much of it. So I tend to be a little more discerning now. But in the old days, it was a romantic time, I think, because you would choose with the money you had to pick the one record that you were going to live with for some certain amount of time. You know, Stevie Wonder, Talking Book, you'd live with forever, you know. Earth, Wind and Fire, All in All, you'd live with that forever, and they would stand out in your mind as this was the standard you had to reach for or listen to, you know. It's different now, different.
Now, let me ask you even more specifically, I mean, when you listen to music, what do you listen for? For instance, like when I hear a new piece of music, I start from the back forward. I mean, I like to listen to the little things that are in the background. I'll notice the drums. I'll notice the keyboards. I'll notice, really for me, I notice the lyrics last, because I'll notice the melodies, but I won't necessarily know what they're saying because I like the melody. And so I listen to music, you know, from the back and work my way front. As a songwriter, how do you listen? What do you listen for?
As you become a songwriter, and I never was that, I was a naive songwriter, just records, 75, you know, early, every record I heard from my parents onwards just moved me, they were magical. So, I listen to, and I think as I've become more experienced, I tend to listen a little bit too much, too technical, because I do hear things in a technical way to a certain degree. But still to this day, it has to just speak to me. You know, and it can be right across the board from a great folk song or a pirate song from the past, or it'll be, you know, Elvis Presley singing Suspicious Minds. I will have to be moved by it. I just have to hear it in the same way in the old days I'd listen back to T-Rex and go, God, Visconti's way he mixed those records, something's happening. But I wouldn't be thinking about how it was mixed. I would just say, it speaks. It touches me. And today, I think as an older person, I can usually hear something that I want to go to live with a bit longer, want to go in a bit farther. I'm interested in an artist, you know. But the first thing I hear, really, if I was really truthful about it, is the color of a record, the color of it. And that color means melody and tones. I tend to hear tones quickly and go like, ah, this is my cup of tea. It's got something in there that is really speaking to me. So I tend to, still, even though I'm, you know, I'm a writer, I tend to go, something has to be almost like, wow, that gets me.
Yeah.
That gets me. Just gets me. As simple as that, really.
Andrew, would you listen to your music? Are you big picture? Do you get ever technical? Do you?
I think I probably jump around a lot. I mean, I do. Lately, I listen to a lot of classical music and a lot of jazz, and that I manage to stay completely aesthetic with. And, you know, does it move me, and do I like the general harmonic structure to it, or the way this guy is playing? And, like, I saw an old documentary about John Coltrane, and it just completely blew me away. And I couldn't tell you if it sounded good or bad or whatever. When I'm listening to stuff that's more in the genre that I work in, when I listen to rock albums, I find it a lot harder to switch off and just listen. There's certain bands that I still do, like Radiohead or Motor Psycho or some of the bands that I love. I don't notice the records going by, but if I don't love it, I immediately will start in with, the kick drum's not so solid, and that bass part's not that interesting, or, you know, I'll start ripping it apart as if I were working on the record, even on first listen, which is not necessarily good.
I think, you know, I just want to jump in there that also, you know, when we, music is such an intangible art, and it's invisible, and it's touching us, but we still don't really know what it is. It's just touching something in us, which, you know, lights us up. When you meet people, you either feel something from them or you don't. You get a friendship or there's something going on. Music, right. When I hear a song sometimes, or a record, it's the same kind of thing. I instantly know if I like it or not. You know, to a certain degree, something happens. And you go, I'm familiar with this. I like it. And then you hear just one melody change. And you go like, nice move.
Yeah.
Without even being technical, but it's washing over you the same way you might meet a person. You know, you something's happening.
Well, there's nothing.
And it's a little spiritual, really.
Yeah, yeah. No. I mean, for me, a great moment is when you hear a piece of music and then there's just this unexpected change, and it just works well. It's just like, wow, you know, or they're taking a bridge someplace and then they got to get back to the
something's wrong.
And all of a sudden, you know, it changes or the series of chords or things like that. You know, on that note though, there's a lot of artists that I haven't gotten into until I've heard their album 5 or 6 times, because it's just actually Frou Frou was that.
Right.
You told me, Martin said, hey, you gotta listen to this album. There's just a lot of really cool things going on there and it's really emotional. And I heard it the first time and I was like, yeah, it's kind of cool. There's some cool sounds. And then I started, you know, kind of digging into it, and you hear it again and hear it. And next thing you know, you hear like emotion on like a pad. You hear like a keyboard pad that just can put emotion just to the sound of the keyboard pad. And it's just amazing.
That happens a lot though with, especially now, because there is so much music that I think sometimes you have to get used to the genre before you can even hear the music. Because it's like, for me, and I've thought about this a little bit too much, it's a lot like eating food in some ways. When if you've never had Thai food and then you have some Thai food, you don't know which dish you might like or whatever. Your brain has to get used to it. And maybe you think you don't like spicy, and then you come back and you're like, I don't know, it was kind of cool, a little bit spicy. And 6 months into eating Thai food regularly, you start to really know about Thai food, and you know what you like and what you don't. And with music, you get into a genre, or not even necessarily a genre, but just something presented in an odd way, something that would normally have live drums that's got a drum machine or something like that. And I don't know if on first listen, other than just saying melodically, I think it's cool or whatever, sometimes you can't even assess it. You have to let it sink in a little bit and come back to it.
Rob, when you listen to music, how do you listen to music? What do you listen for? What specifically do you listen for?
You know what? I'm gonna come off as a weirdo if I answer this question honestly, but I'll answer it honestly.
Go honest. You know, we only got 2 listeners.
Okay, good.
That's weird.
Yeah. And one of them's Bobby. Yeah.
Hello.
Well, this is going to sound a little strange, but I have always sort of listened to music in a visual way, which is ever since I was a little kid, when I would hear a piece of music, I would sort of, in my mind's eye, see a visual representation of it. And the first artist I was ever listening to when I was like 3 years old was Stevie. And I also loved the Supremes and other Motown stuff. And I used to wear out the Supremes records. I mean, I would play them over and over and over and over and over. And early Stevie, I mean, I was just so into it as a little kid. And as I got older and I started studying piano, I started piano when I was 3, because I used to listen to Stevie and other artists, and I would go to a piano and kind of pick out the melody. And so my parents thought I had a good ear, so I would.
I can't remember being alive at 3.
You know what?
Amazing.
I remember listening to music at 3 vividly. Wow. But as I learned how to read music and write music and stuff, I realized that what I was seeing in my mind's eye when I would listen to music would be basically the score. So if I would hear a melody, I would basically see the notes of that melody. And my parents discovered early on that I had perfect pitch. And it just – there was sort of this weird connection between my ears and my visual senses to the point where by the time I was a teenager, if I would listen to a pop record, I would kind of see the whole score. It's like, okay, I know what the bass is doing. I know what the melody is. I know what – the chord progressions are, and it would get harder and harder. If I heard like a new Earth, Wind and Fire record for the first time, I couldn't get all the chords on the first listen. But as I would just develop this skill over the years, I would just more and more see the music visually as I'd listen to it. And I'm profoundly colorblind. So my vision is not good. A lot of what I guess would be visual abilities for me got translated over to my ears, but it resulted in this weird sort of connection between visual representations of the music and what I was listening to. And honestly, as a producer, it's really handy to have that kind of sensibility because, you know, I can, when I've done like big movie trailers with a big orchestra, I can stand out in the room. And if, you know, one of the violins is a little off, I can basically tell what just happened. Instead of something's out of tune, it's like, well, the second violin is flat. You're supposed to have a C sharp. You're playing a, you know, C and a half.
Wow.
So it's actually ended up being a good skill, and the color blindness doesn't usually affect me too much, except that I didn't realize until recently that my console has green and yellow lights and that they mean different things because they look the same.
How are you at traffic lights?
Top light means stop, bottom light means go. Yeah. I have issues with all that, but, you know, as a musician, I mean, when I first started with Stevie, which was like a dream come true because I'd listened to him my whole life. But when I started touring with him, part of what I would do is I would play the keyboards if he wasn't there to play them.
Right.
And I, night after night, I'd learn his parts just by listening to them. And that's maybe my only natural ability on earth is just to be able to listen to music and then know what it was to recreate it.
And also total recall of everything you've ever played or heard, basically.
Well, that
right?
was always my trick as a kid. As long as I've heard a song, I can play it. And so when I was a teenager,
wow.
it was.
Did you parties?
I did. When I was a teenager, the trick was always that I would play TV commercials and TV theme songs. Like if I was at a party, I'd sit down at the piano and then 8 hours later, I'd get up having played every song on television.
Can you play this song for me?
Hey, it was great in high school. It's not all that marketable now, but
yeah. But I'd really like to hear the Gilligan's Island theme.
That
the
could
piano.
Be arranged.
You could work at Magic Castle. Actually,
you're not the first person to point that out. Actually,
yeah.
Steve, how do you listen when you listen to music? How do you listen to music? I mean, do you ever technically dig into it or do you?
Sure. You know, for me, it's pretty cut and dry. I'm either thinking about it or I'm not. I'm either tearing it apart or I'm not. You know, and some of it I just kind of, and sometimes the same piece of music I'll do both. I'll let it wash over me. I'll listen to it in the background. You mentioned the Stevie Wonder records. We used to, starting with Music of My Mind, we used to, when those things would come out, it'd be a religious event for my brothers and me. We just would wear those things out. They would just be on constantly. You know, spending the synths, the subtleties with the synthesizers and stuff, you know, just used to blow my mind. You know, I was way, way into progressive rock growing up in high school and, you know what I mean, ELP and Yes right. and all that stuff and, you know, Genesis and everything. And I even, we toured one time, I toured with a group that opened for, what was Brian Ferry's band?
Roxy Music.
And, you know, I wasn't a huge Roxy Music fan. And then I had, there was a guy who did my keyboards for a while, and I heard him, his name is Ed Simeone, maybe some of you know. And I heard Ed Simeone talking to a guy one time. He says, if you listen to Avalon and you can't get laid, well, then you just can't get laid. If you play Avalon with a girl, you know what I mean?
It just was just very, like Ed, actually.
Yeah. Right? And he was right. You know, that was just, that's a, you know, just an ad, there's albums like that where you just, they're just, they're great mood music and they just, you know, wash over you. And, it's either that or I'm tearing everything apart, you know. It's one, kind of one or the other for me. But, you know, what you said, Martin, was really profound. All of that is, it's really different these days. It really used to be.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Such an event, you know, to be able to spend $7 of your money or whatever for an album to come out. And, you know, we used to really pick and choose, and for some groups it was a huge event. And
you lived with it, didn't you?
And you sure lived with it. And
yeah, it's been a while since an album's hit me like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you wonder if it's because of the technology, you know, because I know myself, I go like, you know, there's so much coming at me, and how much time are you, you know, do you have to delve in? It's hard to analyze now, but there's so much coming.
And you can't analyze it the same way because...
No, it's different.
One of the bands that I really like all their albums is Hybrid. I don't know if you guys, they're a electronica group, and just great orchestrations, and I have their first two albums, and they're actually on CDs, and I can really dig into it, and you can hear a lot of the subtleties. Why I bought their third album as a off of iTunes, and you just, you know, you hear the compression and you just miss a lot of the little subtle nuances. I just think it's just, I can't get into it. Like, even though I like the album, it's just not the same experience.
You hear the compression from the MP3 or 4
exactly,
or whatever it is you're listening to?
Exactly, the AAC. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I'll probably end up buying that, you know, as a CD because, there was just something cool about going over to your friend's house and saying, listen to this, and, you know, staying up late, and you really like that? Listen to this one, and you're putting CDs in and out and things like that. And I think that's one of the downsides of technology making music so accessible is, like, you know, you can go into iTunes and buy, you know, four albums or even bits of albums, you know.
And a little bit throwaway as well, because, you know, you go, I'll go on, I'll take this. But in the old days, we used to have to say, we want to live with this because we know it's special.
Right.
And I need to give it some time, and it's all my money I'm putting onto this.
Yeah, I remember a few times buying a record by a band. I liked all their previous albums, and it was such an experience that it would take you about 30 listens to say, you know what? No, this is actually not good. It would take that long before you could overcome your expectations with it.
Yeah. Hey, Scott, how do you listen to music, and what do you listen for in your music?
I think I listen in multiple different ways. I do agree with Martin in that when I work out, to me, I know it sounds corny, music is kind of the underscore of life.
Right.
And different types of music work different parts of me. When I'm driving, I like to hear one kind of music. Being a film guy, for me, when I look at visuals and we put music against it, that to me is music. I don't care whether it's music I would never listen to, like just sitting down with an album, listening to it, I might hate it.
Right.
I'll put it against picture, and all of a sudden, it's powerful, it's angry, it's whatever the style of music, all of a sudden, to me, visuals and audio work together.
Right.
So for me, it's trying to create the emotional underlaying of a piece of visual that I'm working on. And I find that my taste in music is much greater, especially when I tie it to the visual side. Like when, you know, I was doing Natural Born Killers or something, or you get some really aggressive when doing something where having Rob Zombie and Marilyn Manson and just something very edgy. All of a sudden, it's perfect for the scene.
Right.
Or then there'll be an amazing orchestral piece, or even jazz. And it's just seeing what the music does to emote the emotional side on the visual side. For me, I like a lot of everything. I love rhythm stuff. I do agree that you used to buy albums and it just was pretty profound in your life. And I don't know if it's that we're a little tainted because we've been in the business and we're now thinking very differently. I mean, before, everything was new. It was all new sounds, new ideas. We were learning. We were in such a huge growth pattern of our lives that we were trying to absorb everything. And I don't know, but I still love – I mean, music to me, it's either simple. It either grabs me and takes me somewhere or it doesn't. And that's just the way I kind of – listen to it.
Yeah, music is definitely, you know, like you said, the soundtrack to your life. I mean, because music can just bring up moments that, like, you know, Hold the Line with my.
Oh yeah, but there's songs that you may have said I hated that or wasn't really cool to like it
right
at the time, and then you go back and you hear it and you go, oh my god, I love that.
The fact that lyrics were the last thing you listened to, that's why you're a total fan.
You know, that absolutely could be. Cause
trust me.
Because it really is true. Well, hey, guys, I'm going to ask a couple of questions out there because of, you know, listening to music and how music affects us. And we're all going to be, you know, we're going to put on our honest hats here because We want some honest answers here.
Come on, Andrew.
As opposed to the rest of that crap.
No, because we're going to get into the realm of like guilty pleasures. So like if anybody actually has listened to a Michael Bolton song, you know, I want you to.
Disparimental.
All right, ready? First question. Have you guys ever listened to a piece of music and it's made you cry?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
What song?
You remember?
Hot Rod Hearts. Sometimes the stupidest song in the world, for some reason, will, if, you know what, and it's more about, for me, it's more about the chord changes than it is about the lyric that's going on. If someone does a really cool chord change, it can bring a tear to my eye. Think of old, you know, Lisa, whoever, back in eighth grade or something, you know.
And, when you were playing Avalon, right? for me, you know, I've cried a lot of times with music. I mean, a lot of times, because there's also, even when you're writing your own songs and you've got the headphones on and you're into it and you're into what you're doing, sometimes you just get touched by it and it moves you and you go like, this is pretty amazing. And for the reasons that it just, you know, goes inside your chest. I think there's a song, it was a big hit in England, by Marvin Gaye, Abraham, Martin and John, but it wasn't really a single in America. And I always remember that really moved me, just because, you know, it hits you at the right time and you're thinking about something. But the last time I can remember is, you know, playing my own work on the song and then going, that's a good move. As Steve said, a good chord change and something quite churchy takes place and spiritual. And you just go like, my goodness me, I've got a shiver right to the core of me. Yeah. I break down a lot.
Andrew?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of specific ones. I mean, I'm definitely get moved by certain things. I mean, there are things that make, you know, the hairs stand up and things. I mean, I think that a recent one where I was really emotionally kind of under the bus was the Johnny Cash version of Hurt. And especially when I saw the video with he and June in their house. And right after I saw that video was when he died. And then I saw an old 60 Minutes interview with him and talking about how much he loves June and just the amount of love between that couple, and she'd saved his life many times and things. So just the combination of all of that. I mean, I think the song itself, his rendition of that song is pretty outstanding. But
Rob?
Well...
Rob, you just saw the notes go by.
Yeah, I did. Of what Andrew, it was all B flat. No, I have to be honest, I don't usually get moved to tears by music. It doesn't happen that often.
If it's a no,
it's okay.
That's
okay, good. apparently. But there is one moment that I will never forget when I did completely, totally lose it. And that was, it was on a Stevie tour. And it must have been in 87 or 88, maybe a little bit later, 89. But we were in Asia, and I'll never forget the day of the show. We had landed wherever we were I think it was in Taiwan, actually. And my grandfather had died that day. He had been sick for a long time with cancer, and he had passed away that day. And I found out as soon as we arrived in town. And it wasn't a surprise, but, you know, it still hits you hard. And that night at the show, I was sitting on the side of the stage, and Stevie... He changes the set list all the time. There, you know, often there isn't a set list. But he was singing that song, I'm not sure what the title is actually, but the lyric is, "You said you would never leave in summer," which is an unbelievable ballad. I mean, this ballad will bring anybody to their knees. Right. And he started singing that, just him and the piano, and I was on the side of the stage and my grandfather had just died, and I lost it. I mean, I completely, totally lost it. Wow. 'Cause just that lyric, you know, "You said you'd never leave," and I was super close to my grandfather, and that was,
man,
I definitely unraveled.
Wow.
But then I manned up, and I've been fine ever since.
Scott?
No, it's easy. I have two favorites, and that is, this goes back to film, James Horner's theme for Glory.
Mm-hmm.
When the Harlem Boys Choir kicks in, I worked on the film, and every time I heard of it, I just sat there. My jaw was open, and to this day, if I see it on like TiVo or something, I'd go to it just to hear the music, and I just sit there and, you know. And the other one was actually John Williams has a little trumpet part for Born on the 4th of July, which is incredibly lonely.
Right.
And I it just, I don't know, just all the...
There's a new movie out now which called Amazing Grace, you know, and they do, at the end, they do play Amazing Grace, but it's by the Scottish, you know, Pipers.
Right.
And that will bring, that brought me to my knees as wow. well. That was really emotional.
I've got two instances where I've been really emotional, and I've only, these are the only two times I've actually
Honky
cried.
Honky Tonk Woman by Rolling Stones. No.
And Hold the Line.
Because of the lyrics.
Candle in the Wind?
No, actually the first time was my very first tour with Stevie. We were in Brunei, and you know, I was a working tech, and so you take the work when you had it. And so I had the tour for Stevie, and my daughter, my wife was pregnant, and my daughter was late. So I actually was on the road with Stevie when my daughter was born, and I'll never forget sitting there on the day that my daughter was born, listening to Stevie, and he played "Isn't She Lovely." The other time I was on the Budweiser Superfest as a tech, and it's a big, heavy R&B rap type of
you
a tour.
You were drunk, right?
No, but I got into folk music because I was just so over, just, you know, just inundated with the whole R&B tour that I started listening to a lot of different albums that I would never have. And then there was this group called The Story. I don't know if you guys know. It's Jonathan Brook, anyhow. There's a song, Angel in the House, and it literally was just this repetitive keyboard part at the end that I was listening to it. I was on the tour bus, and it felt like it just had this repetition that just like, man, I've been out here a long time. I want to go home. And it was just this little, little chord progression that just got me at the end. And that was two moments of mine that the music is just overcoming. And let me ask you guys another one. Ever listen to a song and it's made you angry? Just really gotten you really aggressive. Just
you mean angry at the music?
Just brought up.
That's
just,
easy. Anything by Rush. Do it for me.
It can get you angry at the music. It just can just pump you up. It just
come on, wrong just
no. It's an easy. Hey, I'm.
So I like Rush.
A lot of people know the music was fine, but Geddy Lee's voice did something to me. It was just like Drano in my ears, and it just drove me nuts.
Okay, really quick, anybody else? Because we're running out of time, and I just need to hear song titles or experiences.
Oh come on!
Angry.
Music that makes you angry.
Just gets you aggressive. Maybe angry is the wrong word, but just aggressive. Because I'm not
Marilyn Manson. I mean, you know, I mean, there's a whole genre of music. Yeah, that's just pretty angry and yelly and aggressive. And
well, I mean, energized maybe. Like the first Living Color album when that came out. I'd get pumped up listening to that record.
But pumped up as in, or you just want to start beating on something.
Just pumped up like you just have this aggressive. Not because everybody gets pumped with music. I'll give you an example, like the Matrix soundtrack, the first one. That just had some music on it that was just aggressive, and every time I listened to that, I was just. It wasn't pumped up. You were just like, you know, if I was going to be Ultimate Fighting, that would be the soundtrack.
Absolutely.
I don't think I have that in me.
All right. Well, we're going to move on because I want to hit at least this next one. Okay, really quick, the best romantic song out there for you guys. One or just one that just, you know, it doesn't have to be. Well, it can be one that puts your wife in the mood or puts you in the mood or...
So we're talking about...
Oh, so now it's sex.
You know, come on. It's all the thing. Okay, In the Air Tonight, Phil Collins has to be one of the sexiest pieces of music out there. You know, that's just a sexy song.
Is it? Oh.
Kind of rethinking your answer.
You guys made me think of Stevie Wonder. You and I used to just kill me.
Yeah, you and I is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Very romantic.
I mean, I'd go for the era, really, with when Marvin Gaye was doing, you know, Mercy, Mercy Me and What's Going On and Let's Get It On. I mean, his albums around that time, you could just lie down and, you know, listen, put the candles on and hope that somebody knocked on your door. You know?
Play the music as loud as the window. See, the most romantic tune is the song you heard when you were getting laid for the first time. Or the second time.
And what was that, Scott?
Rush. No.
That's an interesting question, though.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, listen, we're going to have to wrap this up. But I just want to, for everybody that's listening out there, both of you, if you want to write, if you want to write in and just, you know, send us some stories on how you listen to music and what you listen to, it'd be really great. And we'll read them on the air the next, podcast that we do. Steve, I want to thank you for joining us today at the Audio Now.
Thanks for having me.
Are you working on anything interesting right now?
I just finished a series called Rains. It'll be on NBC this Thursday at 10 o'clock.
Brilliant.
Yes. So,
but by the time this is posted, last Thursday at
10 o'clock.
And it was really good.
And the following Thursday, though, right?
So, yeah. Sure.
There you go.
Great. Scott, how did everything go at the developers?
The computer... Game Developers Conference. I know I can talk. No, it was great. We launched the IESD, Interactive Entertainment Sound Developers. We are now opening up in, oh, goodness, about 12 cities around the world. And over the next 2 months, you're going to hear a lot about it. We're going to be got a little thing on mix and more stuff to come out. And it's exciting. I mean, it's pro audio in the interactive world, which is not only just video games, but computer entertainment. And, you know, the backing we're getting is amazing. We've got Dolby on board. We've got, all these companies are just lining up to see how they can support us. And it's exciting. More to come.
Well, that's great. And, Andrew, you're going to be working on anything fun and exciting? You probably can't talk about it.
Yeah, I'll tell you next time. When I'm done working on it. Well, I'm tracking a record at my house this week, actually, which should be a lot of fun. Pretty aggressive record. And it's just bass and drums. No guitars, just bass, drums, vocals, and it's heavy. And it should be a lot of fun.
Sounds
it.
Drums. Yeah. That should really piss Rob off.
Yeah, really. It's not even any high drums, right? It's like no hi-hat. It's just kick and bass. And
yeah, floor tom.
Floor tom.
And some guttural.
But he plays floor tom through pedals, right?
Yeah. So it's got and character. Geddy Lee's singing.
Excellent. Excellent.
And Rob, you doing anything?
I'm learning how to use a D control. And that'll be my answer for the next few podcasts, I think.
Well, you know what? In a couple of podcasts, you're going to have to give us a rundown after you figure out the red and, I mean, the green and the yellow issue. And,
yeah, actually, you know what? Anybody who isn't colorblind can't really appreciate what an impact it has, but it really, you know, I've helped design a lot of equipment over the years and a lot of software and I guess I do it from a different sensibility because of the color blindness, but it's amazing how just standard equipment off the shelf a lot of times eludes a colorblind person in some ways.
Wow.
We'll do a series of podcasts on it eventually, I'm sure. No one cares. Anybody colorblind cares.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
And Martin, you're getting close to launching your website. You're a couple weeks away.
Yeah, you're helping me with that as well. But I've got the MySpace pages up and going, and I've just done my first blog, which is exciting because I didn't even know what it was when I first started it. And been with your help, we've been going into some of the editing of some of the previous gigs we've done in the past. So we're getting the visuals together for that. And I met with the guy who's doing my professional website, working on that now. And I would imagine I'm literally 3 weeks away from posting the first songs up. And obviously, I'd like to play the songs here at first.
Yeah, actually,
well.
we're gonna get the opportunity to play some of the songs from the Audio Nowcast.
All right. Nice.
So, and I actually had the honor of listening to the whole album. Front to back, it's fantastic.
Thank you, Mike.
It's really fantastic.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
And it'll be really great. Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to be with us and join us on any of the podcasts and sit on in, you can go ahead and email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com, audio@nowcastnetwork.com. And if you have any questions for anybody, and if you want to, you know, if you want to even ask Steve any questions, we'll forward it onto him. Just email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. All right, well, from all the guys and myself, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbitier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaolo and uses Apex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.